Basically, true. All animals are terrifying, and I don't usually advise people to go outside as my general recommendation.
I just want to know about aliens.
Yeah, I may or may not, you know what we can see and not see.
I love that answer. Oh, my gosh. Because that's just thing, confirmatory right? for me.
We sometimes post images of, you know, Chinese or Russian capabilities. I posted one of a Chinese satellite, and then China took a picture of one of Vantor's satellites and posted it. So they're watching what cool. commercial companies are doing, and they know that that capability is useful.
Is the U.S. about to attack Cuba?
My headline for this is, the GWAT is over. Long live the GWAT.
I will note, Suzanne, Georgetown and Duke, have you ever thought about coming west? It's pretty cool out here.
Yeah. Don't do it. It's the wrong coast.
Have not. I honestly have not.
Same.
I'm not much of an adventurer. I think I'm here in the DC area forever.
Yeah. There's no water out west, unfortunately.
Disagree. We got 3 inches of rain in Bozeman over the weekend. I don't know what you're talking about.
Though I have 2 kids, and we came out last year to see Yellowstone, and my kids had never, there's no mountains out here. And so when they were out there, like, all they wanted to do, they weren't on their iPads in the car. All they wanted to do was look out the window and look at the mountains. And I was like, this is a nice change.
I always think about bison, like,
and
childhood vacations are such a funny thing, right? Where you're like, I'm going to take my kids to the most amazing places, and it's a crapshoot as to whether or not they're going to be like, oh, the Grand Canyon, amazing. Or they're going to be like, I'd rather play with this piece of trash. And they don't realize.
We had this great guide who was like taking them out in the field, and they spent a lot of time analyzing poop and fur and like understanding how all of that like plays into the ecosystem. I was like, great, we spent a lot of money on a vacation for you guys to like dig poop, but here we are.
And they don't know yet. It'll be many decades before they realize they'll probably never do that. The odds of them doing that again are very, very low.
Suzanne, I thought you said you weren't good at doing cold open material. That's perfect cold open material for us.
Open. That was my first cold opening.
Open Yellowstone Park is right down the middle.
Exactly. Yeah, scatological, you know, introduction to the Simon, if you were to say definitively, you have to choose one of these, Yellowstone or Glacier, when it comes to national parks.
Glacier. Full stop.
100%. Me too. Yeah, I'm
every day
of
the year. There's a reason why it's much harder to get time in Glacier. It's because it is it's a much more controlled park. It's still on native land, but it might as well be the moon. Is nothing else exists like Glacier. And then candidly, people think of this wrongly, unfortunately. Yeah. Yellowstone's not Montana's park. Glacier is Montana's
that's
park.
Definitive, totally. The 95% of Yellowstone is actually in Wyoming, right?
The branding is very good for Montana, but like, that's not our park. That's Wyoming's park, and Glacier is our park. It is a fascinating piece of land, but it's extraordinary.
And next time your kids need, you know, access to big game animal, you know, scat, where there's plenty up there in Glacier.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. A lot of bears, right? We did an 8-day backpacking trip through Glacier not too long ago, and we saw every big animal, bull moose, we saw wolverines, we saw wolves,
so big,
deer,
Montana,
elk,
though.
Grizzlies.
Deer in Montana are like 4 times the size of East Coast deer.
Producer Ian can back me up on this. Simon might be thinking of elk and not deer.
Elk are a whole different type of scary. Basically,
true.
All animals are terrifying, and I don't usually advise people to go outside as my general recommendation.
Suzanne, if you don't know this already, Simon is a house cat.
Yeah.
He's a house cat. Indoor one.
Indoor animal.
I mean, we go out to Montana, you know, every October, right? Like, as a group. And I remember walking that road on that like resort ranch that we were on and running into a bunch of deer and just being like, oh no, what do I do? All of them can beat me up. Like, that's my city boy thought is like, what if I have to fight these things? I have no chance.
I think that's what they want.
I don't think that either, but what if they do?
You'll never know.
I don't want to find out. It seems very scary. And I also, because the internet is the internet, right? I see lots of videos of people like harassing animals in Yellowstone and inevitably getting like attacked. And it's their fault because I'm not going 100% near them, trying to slap them on the back or anything.
Yeah, you weren't trying to get some selfies with them.
But I have a healthy respect for any creature that's got 300 to 400 pounds on me. And
Or in the case of a grizzly or a bison, you know, 1,000 pounds.
On thousands. It,
right? Yeah. Well, with all of that, welcome everybody to the Goat Rodeo Podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Smith, and I'm joined by regular co-host Simon Kuhn. Regular co-host Dave Cottle is in uniform this week. He's on annual training as a National Guard infantry officer, leading the men in maneuvers or whatever they do over there in the Pennsylvania Guard. We'll get him after he returns. This week, we are very happy to be joined by Suzanne Hake, who's an EVP and the GM of the U.S. Government Programs and Business at Vantor, formerly Maxar Intelligence, and they're a close partner of our company. Simon and I are both at Reveal Technology. We build software that delivers capability out to the tactical edge of the battle space. And the way that I think of it, our partnership, Suzanne, agree, disagree, is that Vantor's got the water and Reveal's got the pipes. We are the delivery mechanism for a huge amount of value from space-based earth imaging and a whole range of other capabilities, all the way down to the tactical edge of the battle space, into the palms of decision makers, right there in the contested terrain, or right there in the thick of high intensivity decision making. So that's how I just very low resolution kind of take on how we work together. But Suzanne, you've got a long and storied career, not too long, as we covered in the prep session.
Way to couch that.
That's right. Not too long. I am, in fact, I think older than you. So, you know, that if that's useful,
long,
that's
but
useful.
Not too long, but enough, but not too mm-hmm. much. Got
that's
it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Just
I like
the right amount
of shaped like an adult. So years and age have no real impact on anything in my experience.
So to cover maybe the real low resolution biographical summary, and then Suzanne, I'll hand it off to you because we want to get into this, but, you've done time at the NSC, you've done time at Booz Allen Hamilton, and you've done time at Palantir before transitioning to Maxar, now Vantor. And, you know, with that spread of experience and a long but not too long background at all of these entities, I'm curious, you know, we're in the middle of a defense technology renaissance. That's how we think of it. It's been going variably for 5, 10, maybe a little bit more years. Your kind of initial experiences in the national security arena predate that transition, that renaissance. How have things changed, and how are you kind of interpreting that? And is that still energizing for you as an operator in the space?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly energizing to be in this space right now. I joined Palantir in 2013, long before defense tech was cool. Nobody knew what Palantir was. I think for me, it was a big bet to join a company like that. It was a great bet, but at the time, who would have known that anything would happen with Palantir or with this entire industry? So it's been really fun to see all of the energy, the money, the people, the investment coming into defense tech. I do think, you know, given everything that's going on right now, there's also, like, with so many companies and so much momentum, I think that one of the big trends I'm seeing is just a lot of, like, oversimplification of this market. Like, oh, it's going to be so easy to get $100 million contract. We're just going to call our friends in the Department of War. We're going to make a bunch of money. And the hard part of growing and scaling these businesses is all in the execution. And how do you, yeah, you can have great meetings with senior people. You can close some large bookings, but the real companies and what Palantir did well for a long time is, like, slog through building and delivering and executing and failing and building and delivering and executing and failing. And I wonder if every company out there today, like, knows that there's going to be such a slog kind of ahead of them. I think there's just a lot of marketing and excitement. I'm curious what you guys see. I mean, you're, you know, a little bit newer to some of this, but you talk to a lot of different companies. Like, do you think they understand all of that?
So Simon and I, again, to date ourselves, if not you, Suzanne, we were both kind of early days Global War on Terror enlistees into the Marine Corps. And then my wife decided that I needed to go to officer candidate school, and a bunch of other stuff happened downstream of that. But we're both combat experience from, like, the early days of the Global War on Terror, when everybody was fighting on an analog basis. You know, the digital revolution had hit the civilian population, but it hadn't quite hit the, you know, the national security enterprise. And I remember vaguely looking across the way at, you know, the Special Operations Task Force analysts who were keyboard jockeying Palantir products and thinking, wow, that's the future and it'll never happen for us, you know, down here in poor little old Marine Corps. And to some extent, that is true. It still hasn't fully transitioned to, you know, all services at all levels. But we were aware, Simon, I don't know if this is true for you. Maybe I'll just speak for myself. I was very aware that there was better out there. And that the technology kind of sector, the civilian, the private sector had stuff that we could use, but it wasn't clear how. So when I transitioned from active duty in the early 20-teens and found myself at Stanford, right in the thick of Silicon Valley, right around the corner from Palantir headquarters, you know, and everything else going on there, I was immediately like shocked by the level of advancement of technology in the civilian, consumer, and even enterprise, you know, arenas, and was totally shocked and confused that that hadn't somehow translated into the military context. And in some places, it still hasn't, you know, 20 years after some of my initial combat experiences. And it's shocking to me. And I think the thing that's going on right now is a recognition of the geopolitics driving a necessity to think differently about defense technology. The venture capital community waking up to the idea that there's money to be made here and a mission to be served. And so it's all kind of slowly mashing up against, you know, all those factors and elements and people and incentive structures are all mashing up against each other. And it's resulting in serious change. And I think a lot of it is rhetorical at this point and not yet material, but I think the leadership in the acquisitions arena and certainly the political leadership is very much on board with retooling and upgrading and upleveling for true 21st century peer adversary kind of confrontation or competition better than outright conflict. But that's been my experience. Simon, is that true for you?
So, I mean, just to touch on being old, but not old, it is weird to think of myself as an early days GWAT guy. Cause you know, I got to Iraq during the surge and I remember thinking like the war was over. We missed all of Fallujah 1 and 2 had already happened. So we were like, the real fighting's done. And that was just year 3 out of 3 or 4 of 12. What really the first time I've thought of it in that way, which is really upsetting. The Marine Corps I was in, this was not a thing in any way whatsoever, right? Kids were getting yelled at for bringing their own pouches or even attempting to like get better body armor, even as the MRAPs and like counter IED technology was being explored. I, as a junior enlisted, could not even like fathom how this got here or what the process looks like. So I was like, oh, this thing got here. It doesn't work. Turn it off. And that was Blue Force Tracker in a nutshell. It was like, turn that thing off. We don't care. And then we would go on like Yahoo Maps and print things out. And like, this works for us.
I remember that. Yeah.
Just insane way of solving our own problems at like the internet cafe.
I remember having a friend way back here in the continental United States downloading and saving screen grabs of early days Google Maps to augment my mission planning, you know, set of products, because all of the intelligence, you know, cell capability that lived above me and was supposed to support our operations just couldn't respond, right? Like the idea of commercial satellite data, maybe to segue us back into, you know, talk tracks useful for inclusion of the Vantor perspective, like that was a different universe. Like we weren't even thinking about that. We didn't understand what that meant or how to engage with that. You know, it was just national technical means and U2s and stuff that was like impossible to get cycles on. Right. And like, we were way downstream of all that capability. I think the teens, there was a transition away from exquisite high-end technology in the space domain for imaging critical areas in Earth. And again, that usually was only used at high level or high echelons and special operations task forces. And I think the average infantryman would still never be, or at least in the teens, would never have been exposed to the high end of commercial satellite imaging. But what's been that transition for you, Suzanne?
Well, I was just gonna say, I think there's also something to be said though, when you both were talking about like just being really scrappy, figuring out what you needed to solve a problem. And if you look at, you know, the trends in the defense tech community, what I think is so important is that new companies like keep that mentality that you're there to solve a problem. What is the actual problem you're solving? And are you actually solving it? Or is what you're building working well out in Silicon Valley in a lab on the latest computers? I worry that as there's more and more companies coming, like they're kind of living, you know, living in a myopic world of building something that engineers and behind their desk think is great, but they're not actually thinking about how is this going to solve a problem. And if a new technology or new capability doesn't fit into the entire ecosystem, someone's still going to print out a map and do what they need to do. It's like the problems, in some ways, there's been so much progress. And then in other ways, I think about, like, I'm still out there talking about, like, hey, we need data integration. I'm like, oh my God, Palantir was founded after 9/11 on the concept of we need data integration. And here we are still being like, we need data integration for command and control systems.
Yeah.
So I'm both like, I'm very excited and optimistic about everything. And I guess maybe what's great is there's still a lot of problems to solve.
There were many reasons why Palantir has been a massive success story in this way. First is just kind of the venture capital backing to allow them to spend years in the trenches slogging, like you've described. A second was that they very, very clearly and early decided to build a forward deployed engineered model, which allowed them to short circuit the engineer to operator or engineer to end user kind of like feedback loop, which allowed them to develop technologies that were relevant for the warfighter and not just relevant to an engineer sitting back in California, right? So I think that was yet another of the reasons for its success. Did you see, actually, you know what, rather than asking more questions about Palantir and kind of the history there, how does Vantor maintain that level of connectivity? Because Vantor, Maxar, right, like you've been successful in deploying commercial grade space imaging capability, but you're still in the business of solving problems. Like, how do you maintain connectivity with the end user or the operator?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very similar what Palantir did, and a lot of the people coming out of Palantir like grew up with that mentality. And if what's great is they've taken it to all of these new companies and startups. And so the way that we think about operating at Vantor has a lot of similarities of, yeah, we're bringing commercial capabilities, but it's really what problems are we solving for our customers? And a lot of that means doing the exact same things, going out into the field, sitting with users, testing capabilities. Some of our capabilities like that are more, you know, some of the more advanced things we're doing in space and non-Earth imaging, which we can talk more about, those aren't quite as easy to test in the field with users because of the domain that you're operating in. But I think that mentality still stands true at Vantor.
Undoubtedly. And I think what we've noticed in the course, over the course of partnering with you and partnering with others in the space, is that there is, amongst the high performing new entrants to the industry, to include Reveal and others, an example of this might be the Anduril kind of Vantor Reveal complex that's delivering really great terrain-based imaging and analytics all the way down into programs aimed at enabling better decision making at the tactical edge. So it's been my experience that the high performing of this set all take some lessons learned from that Palantir forward deployed engineer kind of tight connectivity, closing the gap between engineer and operator or engineer and acquisitions officer. Has that been your experience in partnering with us? I mean, feel free to, you know, give us some live notes.
Yes, it has been
notes.
A great experience.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was fishing.
I was fishing. Yeah.
But no, I think that's a great example of the work that we're thinking about. One, maybe from a Vantor perspective, is like the evolution of our company of going from a like more traditional commercial data provider, satellite imagery company into a solutions company. That's the Maxar to Vantor transition. And that particular project that we're doing, I think, exemplifies that because we're thinking about how do we take our imagery, build this high resolution 3D terrain, and then how do we make sure that that terrain is super valuable in the field? And I mean, you probably know better than I do how important 3D and understanding terrain is when you're doing mission planning and navigation, bringing drones into the field. And so, and you need to test all of that in the field because that's the only way you're going to understand what's working or not.
Yeah, no doubt. Simon, I think I stepped on you a bit earlier. You want to take this in a direction?
I want to rewind us, but okay. I I have so many threads I want to pull on here that I think are so interesting, Suzanne, from your experience. And I think I am, this could be shocking to Garrett, a contrarian in some regard as it relates
to
the concept of a forward deployed engineer.
Okay.
Just because I remember being deployed and meeting tons and tons of traditional contractors, because GWAT was such a contractor heavy war, right? So I don't think that what Palantir did wasn't very smart, but I also feel like they took a thing that existed in the boring version of contracting and applied a different commercial lens on it. What I still think of Palantir's like truly killer edge is like data ontology and just like really getting after a data problem that's the moat, right? It's very easy to see FDEs and be like, cool, I'm going to do that too. I'm going to hire Green Berets and I'm going to send them out with our stuff. And like, there's no way to really protect that beyond being a thought leader, but your moat is really like that big data and having spent years of organizing and integrating and shifting it around. And when I think about, you know, where you are now at Vantor and the time you spent there, I wonder, do you feel yourself in positions that are similar to the contractors that I interacted with, you know, in 2006 and 2007, where, you know, the longer you do business with DoD, the more you start to look like your customer. It is the nature of the beast that you will mold yourself to them. It's very hard to get them to mold to you. They're a $1 trillion entity. It is what it is. And do you see partnerships with folks like Reveal and these smaller companies as like opportunities to kind of like freshen up the blood, so to speak, right? Like we are still in a position where it behooves us more to take on risk and try to like swing for the fence than it does to very quickly morph ourselves to the customer. Whereas for, at this point, Vantor, Maxar, Palantir, you've got hundreds of millions of dollars riding on these contracts that require execution to the letter of the contracting. And it's not that we don't have contracts, but they're smaller in scale. And, you know, if we break some eggs in the process, it's not like the end of several hundred jobs. It's a reset and we'll raise some money and figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, Vantor, Maxar, Digital Globe, all of its predecessors, it's a company that's been around for, I don't know, 25, 30 plus years, depending on when you decide is the founding of the company. And I think there's a risk with any company, to your point, Simon, that's been around for a while, that you do just start to, you feel more tied to the customer. You feel kind of just start to act and behave like them, especially when you spend a lot of time with them and you can, in a way, get stuck in their bureaucracy and their process. And all of a sudden you're mimicking them and not thinking differently or creatively. That's kind of the job for any of us leaders, is to step back and be like, okay, how do we get our teams to reset and how do we get them to think differently? And working with other companies and partners is a good way to do that, because it challenges you in different ways that you weren't going to think about on your own. And I think that's why for us, like when I joined Maxar, I didn't feel like we did a lot of partnering, and the company was kind of operating in a silo, delivering its data and its imagery. And we've really tried to shake that up over the past few years, because I think it provides better solutions. We can't build everything ourselves. We're not building what you're doing. We don't want to, we can't. So I think it gives like better technical solutions, and it kind of challenges our team to move faster. Like, your engineers are moving really quickly, my team better be hustling as well, right? So I think those are good, like, kind of light competitive things to bring out as well.
So Palantir, maybe input to this topic is that whenever those kind of two forces interact with each other, you know, a relatively slow, bureaucratized, low risk tolerant government interacts with high risk tolerant, cutting edge technology vendor, like, yes, the vendor will become more like government, but government is also going to become a little bit more like the customer. And so there's some amount of successful company educating the government dynamic going on. So Palantir was one of the reasons why the government got thinking about handling data differently, right? And data integration, data fusion, all that stuff hasn't fully been realized, to your point, Suzanne, but it's on a different trajectory now, in large part because of Palantir's efforts, right? And similarly, Maxar, now Vantor, over its life cycle has been instrumental in educating the users, the customers, the acquisition folks about the value of commercially derived orbital data, right? And so I think, again, like, yes, over 20, 25 years, you've become a bit more like the customer, but they've also just been,
they've adapted. Been educated. Yeah, exactly. That's right. I mean, there weren't, to your point, even what you were saying earlier, Garrett, like you weren't using commercial capabilities. All there really was NTM, whether it was from the Earth observation, more traditional side, or that non-Earth imaging side, there was only government capabilities. And the more that we've, you know, been able to grow and be successful, but also show why commercial imagery is so important, like why is it important to have this imagery unclassified and shareable? Like Vantor's imagery is, it's not even unclassified, it's not classified, right? That's what it means to be commercial. And so it's so important now when there's a lot of joint operations going on to be able to share any imagery and intelligence and things like that. And so, yeah, we've seen a lot more interest. And that's even before kind of the recent executive orders and kind of overall push in the administration for commercial capabilities. Like, I think in particular, the early days of Ukraine, where there was a lot of commercial capabilities and commercial imagery used. While I wasn't here at the time, when I look at the company's history, I think that was a big shift for Maxar at the time and really seeing how commercial capabilities and commercial imagery in particular can be used in these completely different scenarios.
Totally. I'm going to take us in for a slight detour and bring us back with, I think, a similar topic. The venture capital industry is voting on this category. They're voting on defense technology generally, with everything kind of heating up. And usually what we do in our discussions on a weekly basis is cover some of the bigger, more kind of relevant or frothy or whatever, sexy venture rounds. So there are three that I want to talk about. The third will segue us back into the space topic. But Scout AI raised a very large Series A, $100 million. Mach Industries raised a $300 million Series C. And I mean, like, this is yet again the venture industry consolidating bets into category winners. We've talked about that on this podcast before. But the third is Colorado-based True Anomaly that raised a $650 million Series D with a post-money valuation, I think, in the $2 to $2.5 billion range. Maybe one question, and then I'll try and segue this back into things. But space is getting crowded, right? Like, and the venture industry is dumping a ton of money into this. The space industry, I think, has maybe quadrupled in terms of the venture dollars or private investment privately invested capital into innovative, you know, upstart outfits doing different and new things in space. It's getting crowded. Competition seems to be heating up, right? Like, there's all kinds of that kind of dynamic in the industry. How are you thinking about that? How are you navigating that? Is that a partnering opportunity? Is it competition? Is it what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I think this is really exciting. And when I think about the work that I'm doing at Vantor, like the space part of the business is really cool. And if you kind of step back, right, like basically in space, high above the Earth, above everything we're doing, there's a great power competition going on, right? There are these mega constellations. There's dozens of satellites that are getting launched all the time. There's all this debris that's starting to accumulate. And not only is that all happening from the US and US-based companies and US government, but Russia and China are also launching and deploying very advanced spacecraft. And so you have kind of that going on in space. And then if you think about what's happening here on Earth, right, like more and more of our daily lives are depending on space-based capabilities. Like when you do an ATM transaction, like that goes through space-based capabilities. You know, all of our banking, GPS, stoplights, like every single thing relies on something going on in space. And so when you take those two factors, like more things, more complicated, contested, congested piece, and then how much of our life depends on space. I don't know, I think that just puts such an interesting perspective on why and how important that domain is becoming. And that's something that we've been spending a lot of time on as well. As you said, there's a lot of new space companies coming online, like True Anomaly. And being able to understand that space domain awareness, space situational awareness piece is really critical. And there's a like, what is up there? And then not only is there something there, but being able to start to characterize it. And that's something that we've been doing. We take these things called non-Earth images, which is a very creative way of saying an image of not something on Earth. But you can take images of satellites, you can take images of debris, just about anything in space. And then you can start to characterize it and understand what it is. And that's kind of like the next wave of thinking about how do we use imagery in that new warfighting domain.
Because we've been talking about it
as a warfighting domain.
I can see Simon's face. I'm hoping that he segues us in. Well, so I want to talk about.
You know what my first question is.
I'm all about this UFO disclosure movement, but I don't think we should go down that rabbit hole.
Is that because you're scared, Garrett?
I'm not scared at all. I want contact, man. I really want contact and knowledge and disclosure. But let's not go down that rabbit hole, Simon. You've got undoubtedly a more germane topic.
Yeah, no, I'm a skeptic.
Do you want to talk about UFOs?
I want Garrett to go down the rabbit hole because he thinks that there are UFOs. I don't. When I think about this question of like,
I hope
more crowded.
Hold on, Simon. Hold on,
stuff.
Simon, hold on. I hope. I don't know. I don't believe. Belief is a dumb thing in this context. I do hope that there's something going on that we don't know about that's bigger than us. I want to learn about that if it's true. Right. All right. Sorry.
I may or may not, know what we can see and not see.
I love that answer. Oh my gosh. Because that's just confirmatory for me. Like that's,
and you know what? That's being vague. That's being vague.
It's an exciting new era of that because this is, as she stated, non-classified data and imagery. I don't think I'm stretching to say that Vantor Maxar has a much better set of capabilities to photograph what's happening in space than our government does. I would bet money on that. I'm sure we have some exquisite assets that I'm not allowed to know about that exist out there that do really fancy things. But like, as far as scale, the commercial satellite sector has absolutely crushed what the government has access to, which is why I don't think there's aliens, because commercial entities now would have the best opportunity to find it. They're all over there. They're literally blanketing the globe. And I think space debris is the most interesting, challenging problem, I think. I mean, I just watched clips, and I'm sorry to keep stepping on you, but I just discovered what a Dyson swarm is the other day. And I was like, all right, this is too intense. I don't want to know about this anymore. But it's a fascinating space.
You cannot kill the flame of hope in my heart, Simon,
sure,
with your negative commentary here on the nature of UAP, UFO. And
I
space
love
stuff.
That you're hopeful about it because every time it comes up, I get to feel like I'm right because there's no hard evidence yet. So it's like a fountain of youth for Simon is right in personal
Just have to say that I have talked about non-Earth imaging many times over the past 3 years and never, ever once has anyone tied it to UFOs?
God, that's insanity.
They're cowards.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
Susanna,
that's literally the only thing
you
think about.
I want you to know that. This is a whole new turn.
This is why you need to be close to the enlisted folks who are thinking about the real hard problems, such as space is crowded, you're photographing it, what have you found that's weird?
Yeah. Russia, China, adversary capability. Yeah. I just want to know about aliens.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. Yeah. We're not worried about Russia or China. We're not worried about space-based weapons. We are worried about UFOs. I mean,
so
maybe there's not enough conversation about it.
So maybe to make this a bit more serious, just honoring Simon's preferences and getting back onto Suzanne's, reinforcing Suzanne's
actual
career.
Expertise.
Actual expertise. Don't sell yourself short.
What actually is the purpose behind non-Earth imaging? Like, what are you imaging? How is that important to industry, to government policymakers, to warfighters? Like, how does that feed into your work at
I think, it's completely parallel to how imaging is used in more traditional, like, Earth-based fighting. Situational awareness, what's around you. There's this kind of characterization component. So being able to take images of other satellites, and when you're able to take really high resolution images, so you can see a lot of detail, you can start to see like what that satellite might be, right? And so in particular, if you're looking at adversary capabilities, you can see, maybe they have their solar panels, solar rays deployed. You can measure them, and then you can think about how much power they might have, or you could see what sort of payloads maybe they have. It depends on how it's really hard to take images too. Like before we talk about how useful it is, think about how fast everything's moving in space. And so the like math and the orbitology around getting those high resolution images is incredibly complicated. Then you have to analyze them and understand what they are. And there's, you know, other countries are taking notice of these capabilities. Like kind of vignette story for you is that we sometimes post images of, you know, Chinese or Russian capabilities. And one time last year, I posted one of them on social media of a Chinese satellite. And then China took a picture of one of Vantor's satellites and posted it. And so they're watching what commercial companies are doing, and they know that that capability is useful.
I mean, so first, it is so hard to get viable technology into space as a first big step, and then to like transition use cases away from Earth imaging, which I think is Earth imaging or RF detections with Hawkeye 360 and those similar type capabilities, right? All kinds of kind of like Earth-based sensing from orbit. But then to like turn that sideways and look horizontally in the space domain, yet another massive engineering and math problem, right? And obviously it has to be tied to really clear high value use cases to drive that kind of innovation. But I just want to give you guys credit. I know that you're not in the lab, you know, in the
not. I can take no credit, but it is it's extremely impressive to see what the team is able to do when, as you mentioned, the math, the orbitology, like having come from Palantir in a software world, it's great. I love Palantir. We've had a lot of great Palantir talk today, but there's something so like fascinating and gratifying and interesting about the hardware components and then managing these satellites and then not only taking complicated images of Earth, but being able to take them of space. It's pretty cool. So props to anybody who's doing work like that.
It's very impressive. Totally. Like the people involved with building and deploying and even earlier in the value chain, testing and experimenting and all of that stuff. And the capital providers who are taking risks and making bets in this space with the level of capitalization required to make this stuff a reality. I mean, it's no wonder Elon wants to have, you know, SpaceX, you know, public offering. You've got to capitalize this massively important thing that they've been building forever and on which the American or Western kind of space interests rely at this point.
I think that like that phrase, like space is hard, like that still rings very true, right? We saw that last week with Blue Origin, right? This is just really, really technically challenging. And so it's great that there's investors who are willing to take that risk because we couldn't invest in these capabilities without.
Totally. We've only got a scant few minutes left with you, Suzanne, before I know that you've got to hop. Any last words, anything to tie it all the way back to, you know, the importance of this mission or how we're all working together to accomplish or manifest something important for 21st century warfighting? Where would you leave us with the last word?
Wow. Okay.
We've
covered a lot of ground. So, softball. Yikes. Could I just see the past 45 minutes for any of that, those comments?
Sure. Fair enough. Yeah.
I don't have a great closing for you.
How about this? How about this? How about this?
Not about poop.
we could bring it all the way back to that. Where is Vantor headed? Like, what's the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 years for Vantor? Yeah. Like, what is happening for Vantor?
It's really about like the software and the technology that we're building. I mean, we've talked a little bit about this evolution from imagery, the Maxar, into Vantor. And what we're really focused on is how do we take our imagery and turn that into a useful solution? So that could be anything from building out our imagery into the 3D data that we're working with you all on. It could be, you know, running models and doing more maritime domain awareness or monitoring. Like, what is the output? Change detection is really important as well. You know, monitoring the entire Earth. That way you don't need to have people looking at every image, but you're using algorithms to identify when something has changed. And then, you know, there's all of the space stuff that we've been talking about. There's obviously everything going on in space, but we do a lot on Earth, like left of launch monitoring, for example. So being able to monitor launch sites before potentially a missile or something is able to launch. That's been a key part of work that we're doing as well.
No doubt. Yeah, we're excited about what's coming, not least because we're partners with you guys. And we live very much in this kind of application layer that sits between raw data and the end user to accelerate and improve their workflows. And I think we're doing a lot of that work with you, and we're excited. Well, thanks, Suzanne, for joining us. I might keep Simon for one more Garrett Simon riff before we fully wrap, but thank you for joining us.
Look forward to hearing that. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet.
It's been great. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Come back All right. anytime. Thanks, Suzanne.
All right. Bye.
Well, Simon, I thought that was a good conversation, but I want to hard pivot us into, is the U.S. about to attack Cuba? Go for it.
My headline for this is, the GWAT is over. Long live the GWAT.
Okay, sure.
Because all I see...
The non-endless war, endless wars?
All I see when I look at like the deployments out to Cuba, and it's the Nimitz that's out there, right? The Ford is out in the Persian Gulf, and the Nimitz is in the Caribbean. Both of those aircraft carriers have been out for 10-plus months. And I just remember sitting in Iraq and getting either your extended... or you're breaking dwell time notifications. That's all it was, over and over and over. Hey, we're doing a lot of stuff and we don't have enough people. So you guys are going to go do more. Regardless of whether or not we go to war, my heart goes out to like the 12 ships worth of guys that are just like sitting on their hands for 10 months straight in the Caribbean, waiting for something to happen. The most bored Marines on Earth who just want to go do the thing.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts on this one. First, this is very much in line with a lot that we've heard from the Trump administration about kind of spheres of influence and the Western Hemisphere is the United States sphere of influence. And let's kind of detach ourselves from stuff going on elsewhere. Obviously not fully the case with
detach
Iranian conflict, but Trump really wanted to distance himself or the United States from problems related to Europe, hence why there's been a lot of kind of rhetoric and posturing, positioning, and withdrawal from some of the major NATO activities, some of the Ukraine support initiatives, and attempting to kind of like push Europe to take the lead on all of that. Which I don't know, the jury's still out. Obviously, that conflict is far from over, but the Europeans do seem to be stepping up, and the U.S. definitely seems to be stepping back, and so. So first comment is, this is very much in line with the Trump administration's U.S. sphere of influence type of kind of perspective on the world. A second is that in order to have the geopolitical gravity to, impose your will on the world or on targeted places within the world, you have to have a credible threat or a credible kind of... a credible force in waiting. And so like, if you want to put pressure on Cuba, or you want to put pressure on Venezuela, or you want to put pressure on the flow of drugs coming across the Caribbean or through Central and South America, you've got to have assets out there, right? Ready to do the work. And I think I saw a news article, maybe it was a New York Times article, something where it indicated that we've cleared 200 adversary killed, in the kind of Caribbean U.S. NORTHCOM or U.S. SOUTHCOM strikes on drug vessels and that sort of thing. So I, it seems like we're, as a nation, trying to do something down there and put pressure onto historically adversarial actors. But to your point, it can't be easy for, the E2 to E5 spread living in the well deck on the amphib.
Yeah, I mean, I think the jury is still very much out on what the utility of all of these like foreign policy moves are to the actual nation and like our geopolitical stability, because you can pull 20,000 soldiers out of Europe and that does not get you one single boat. And we are a naval force. Our ability to project power is definitively naval. And it has been since at least World War II. That's the nature of the game. Resources that we free up in Europe do not translate to necessary directly anyway project power projection, because we need boats to do it, and at point case in point, right, we're just extending the Nimitz was supposed to retire after this pump, and they have now canceled that, and they're going to try to refit it one more time and make it go back out again after a historic deployment. And there's, you know, there's geopolitical notes on, like, I think that this is much more Marco Rubio's influence in the admin, because we didn't see much of this from Trump 1. I also think that this is our backyard. Our ability to go knock Maduro off within like a relatively short number of months of planning and build up and execution, for the reason we spend so much time in Europe and the Indo-Pacific, is because we are still very much king of the jungle in our hemisphere. We have parked stuff there as a show of force, but if we needed to touch Cuba on short notice, Florida alone has enough military aircraft to wipe out every single scrap of air defense that exists on Cuba and hit a bunch of targets and be home for dinner that night. So, like, you don't need the Nimitz there to do that. We're sending a different type of message. I'm interested to see where it goes. I hope it doesn't go sideways and that we have to see, you know, American lives at risk, because I don't really understand the outcome that we're looking for just as of yet, because I don't think anybody who saw the Maduro and remembers the Maduro raid thinks that the U.S. can't reach out and touch everybody in our hemisphere on a moment's notice if we want to.
Sure. I kind of think that a lot of this is Trump understanding where these kind of 80-20 issues lie in geopolitics. Like, most people can agree the Castro regime, now over many, many decades of repression, oppression, and Soviet involvement in the Cold War and everything else, it represents kind of a vestige of the old, as yet unresolved set of conflicts or ideological struggles that have not been put to bed. And ditto, like, a Venezuela that's been in decline for decades, right? Like, so I think this at some level is President Trump and the administration seeing all these unresolved conflicts that, you know, he and they want to make a dent in history, right? They want to, like, put their mark on things, and they see these as potential opportunities. Ditto Iran, right? Like, whether things are going well or poorly or whatever in Iran is a completely different topic, but they saw an opportunity along with the Israelis to kind of finally correct a multi-decade wrong of allowing Iran to make advancements in nuclear weapons technology and asserting influence throughout the Middle East with asymmetric, you know, warfare and force projection capabilities, Hezbollah, Hamas, et cetera, Houthi rebels, all that stuff. And so, again, I think this is yet another example of the Trump administration trying to find a gap in a seam to resolve something that presidents past or administrations past have not been able to put to bed. And they are looking for opportunities to make history. And
very similar. I mean, this ties back to how we opened it up. That was essentially the justification for invading Iraq. There was a public conversation about weapons of mass destruction, but I think, like, the tenor was very much, this was unfinished. We've tried to fix this multiple times. We're going to rip the Band-Aid off. So, like I said, the GWAT is over. Long live the GWAT. We'll just keep tapping old grudges until we've knocked them all off, I guess.
Would you go as far as to say this is a lower intensity phase of an endless wars kind of configuration that would belie the administration's preferences or stated aims?
I think it's a shocking amount of, like, neoconservative thought coming from, I mean, there's plenty of news reporting on, right, the fracturing of, like, the MAGA political movement.
Sure.
Yeah, I think this is much more in line with, like, a muscly George W. Bush era version of what America's foreign policy should be. I have to knock these guys off because they're bad, and I need to export our values through force. And, like, that's the way to kind of knock that off, which is a surprising turn, or was a surprising turn, Venezuela and Iran. But at this point, I'm like, yeah, this is how this administration seems to be attempting to make its mark in that geopolitical space. Is like, we're going to go knock these like few off that have been lingering.
I think they're managing to dodge the indictment that they are entering additional endless wars by kind of committing in advance to, quote, not put boots on the ground. Right. And,
yeah.
And I think that's a bit of a fallacy. Like, you're still, you know, expending
blood
resources
and treasure, right?
And it's blood and treasure, right? Of a different kind. And, like, thank God we aren't losing lives at the level that we were during GWAT or certainly in previous conflicts. But I think we are running the risk of being pulled into extended conflicts that are low intensity, And much more maybe like Cold War era conflicts than global war on terror or like open warfare like in Vietnam or other things. So it's a fascinating period.
Time will tell, right? But like, what if Cuba turns into an insurgency? An insurgency 40 miles off of Florida's coast.
Yeah, I mean, right? So
we've seen it. I just thought, I mean, they'll have way less access to food than other insurgencies that we've fought, but God.
Yeah, it is an island. I mean, in some ways, it's a lot like, I mean, it's kind of like the American version of a Taiwan crisis, right? Like, right, it's right there. I mean,
yeah.
Right, it's right there. Okay, well, I can't fully see the shirt you're wearing, but
it's a claimed choice.
Per our traditions here, we question and interrogate and then force you to explain the clothing you choose to wear during the podcast. So explain yourself. Claimed choice.
I couldn't have picked a better choice for talking about George W. Bush foreign policy. It's a French punk rock band. Highly recommend it. They put out a record, I think, a year or two ago. Really good stuff. Recommend everyone give it a listen.
I was going to say this is the second French project that we've talked about recently, but Angine de Poitrine is Canadian.
Canadian, French Canadian.
Sorry,
yeah.
Sorry. Well, claimed choice with a arms folded demonic.
Yeah,
silhouette.
It's a very, if you do check it out, you're going to be very surprised to find that the shirt is much scarier than the band, which is very like.
More. Are they more like soft punk? It's more like, you know,
they play a genre called oi, which is like bar rock, essentially. It is like a invented by soccer hooligans in England and has been adopted by lots of different European punk cultures. So, yeah, they're a French oi band.
A French oi band called Claimed Choice.
Yeah.
Brought to you by our very own Simon Kuhn. Thank you, Simon.
Yeah.
Thank you for keeping us at the cutting edge
of the 1960s punk rock culture and revivalists that exist all over the world.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said they recently released it.
They are, yeah. But oi, the kind of punk they make is like very old. They are, as a lot of people these days, right? They're playing like a nostalgic version of stuff. It sounds very 80s. It sounds very 70s. It's not.
What's old is new.
I am not at the cutting edge. I like things that sound like things I already know and understand.
Nothing new under the sun or whatever the saying is. What's old is new. All right. Well, with that, Simon, I bid you good day. Thank you. And grateful to have Suzanne from Vantor in the mix. We hope to have her back. I thought that was a great conversation. And for all those out there consuming this content by video, by audio, by whatever mode mechanism you prefer, refer us to your friends, family, colleagues. Let us know how you feel and think about it, and shoot us some notes. We'd love to cover content that you'd like us to cover. And otherwise, subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Bye.